MK2 Romeo India Whiskey. Hey, we got more audio tonight than usual. I'm a little bit amazed by that. Somebody's been adjusting the gain controls. This is the beginning of the technical net. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick try to organize this crazy enthusiastic crowd that gathers here to discuss ham radio and how all this stuff works. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City, New Jersey, Connecticut area, and we gather once a week and compare notes, teach each other how transmission lines and antennas and transmitters and receivers and propagation and satellites and moon bounce and Arecibo, how does all this stuff work? That's what gets discussed. Quite often a person will bring a question to the TechNet and somebody in some outlying area, sometimes even by way of IRLP or Echo Link and other things, will say, hey, I know something about that. They chime in and give us the benefit of their wisdom. There are no questions that are inappropriate for the TechNet as long as it involves something that is of interest to ham radio operators. That includes wireless equipment and quite a few other kinds of electronics. There's no question that's too dumb, so to speak. Don't worry about that. From Mel and Dick's point of view, the question, that so-called dumb question, is really one that represents the greatest difference between what the person knows and what he would like to know. And therefore, it's most deserving of an answer. So don't be bashful. We usually don't chastise people because of the kinds of questions they ask. Once in a blue moon, we get a question. I guess it's a little bit off. So it's been rather rare. And you won't get...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And there's one of the first things you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to watch your watch, and every minute or so, give an interruption, and wait for the beep, which I didn't do. I'm about to do that. And maybe a couple of seconds beyond the beep to make sure both the eastern Long Island machine as well as the western machine both reset properly, so that people don't get locked out. Once we get going hot and heavy, quite often people will get so excited they don't even wait for the beep. They just pile on top of each other and the machine times out. We've had a few of those happen. We're slowly getting a little better at that. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name. Try to remember to give us your name because I'm awful forgetful. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. After 27 and a half years, this net began in 1982. We don't have to have long lists of people signing in letting us know that they're listening. That's by now assumed. The TechNet for the last quite a few years runs 4 hours every Sunday night. Somebody's out there, otherwise it wouldn't exist this long and it wouldn't last that late. So that's assumed. We don't have to have that proven to us. We also don't start off by saying, is there any emergency traffic? I don't understand why people do that. Is there any emergency traffic? An unusual question. There's never an answer to it, so why keep doing it? Okay, give me your call letters and your name at this time. K2RIW on the TechNet.
November to X-ray Juliet, November. Yes, Wesley. 10-2 Meatball, no questions.
KC2SYL, name is Bill, no questions.
No questions.
P2KYQ, no questions. Good evening. Handles Joe.
Feeling all K2KEY.
Okay. So far, we've got Wesley, Barry, Bill, Bob, Joel, and Mel. And there was a double in there. I know I missed at least one or two people on that double. Please give me your call letters again, K2LIW.
WS2N, Paul with a real question. I must have doubled.
2KYQ, and the handle's Joe, and no questions.
2GHL, no questions.
Okay, we picked up Paul, Joel, and another person. Let's see. One last call. Anyone else with any questions or comments for the net? Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes at this time.
QGZ
Okay, that was Bill, QGZ. And his is a success story about communicating with Arecibo last weekend. I think he's already gotten a QSL card, so he's going to describe what he used, how he did it, and what kind of accolades. Also, when they mail you that QSL card, they also send in there a check with a whole lot of money. Bill's got it made. Okay, one last call. Anyone else with any questions or comments on the net? Give me a call that isn't named at this time. The first person with a question or comment was Wesley, N2XJN. Go right ahead, Wesley.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is November to X-ray Juliet November. The subject I would like to pick up is the low frequency communication, ham radio communication. And there are certain frequencies that were tested for this purpose, and the FCC Part 15 actually allows the broadcast under the special conditions. 17 feet, 50 meters, which is 160 to 190 kilohertz, which actually may become a ham band. And of course, everything below 9 kilohertz is beyond the jurisdiction of the FCC as an untimed word. And because they think there is no law, bad laws of physics in it. Two things. There are two principles in which that low frequency communication is being provided. One of them is utilizing Tesla coils. As a few of the friends of mine know that I am in the process of bringing all of this stuff in order to have my own laboratory, and that's why I've got this information. Well, there are a few good receivers for the low frequency, and those are the frequency selective level meters. And I was actually asking Andy, because he is a very knowledgeable person.
Good evening. The time is 8:09 p.m. W2VL. Repeat.
Back off the mic.
What did he say?
Okay. I don't know what did he say. And, few of them actually are the Cushman CE24 and DX160 from the Radio Shack, actually DX440, the old one, actually is Sangen ATS-803 on drugs, and these things actually are beyond being only the level meters, the frequency selective level meters, they are perfect receivers for it. And I would like to direct the microphone for Dick. He's going to say something more about it, and I'm going to ask a few questions about the Tesla coil communication. Back to you, Dick.
Now, the Tesla coils that I have seen, by the way, what somebody did chime in and let us know is that we have to use a little bit less mic signal, in other words, back off from our microphone. I do notice, because I listen to what's coming back out of the machine, I noticed that the audio gain tonight is set quite a bit higher than usual. I know that quite a few changes have been made on the equipment of our repeater site, and some resetting of setting controls, obviously, has taken place. So we all have to be a little bit careful about not over-modulating. I think somebody's giving us a hint about that. I normally talk about this close, and you can see that it would be quite distorted if I did that tonight. A Tesla coil, when most people use a Tesla coil, it is a kind of a resonating circuit. It's got kind of a an interrupted primary. The way you interrupt the primary in the old days was sometimes done with a an ultrasonic oscillator. Nowadays, it seems like many of the Tesla coil designs that you'll see. Let me drop. If you do a web search, and if you use the word Tesla coil, you'll see lots and lots of articles about people who use high voltage transformers stepping up the 110 or 220 volt line to much higher voltages, where they put it across some kind of a spark gap setup. That in turn gives interrupted current to the primary winding at the bottom of the Tesla coil, the great big long winding in the post in the center with the great big donut, metallic donut on the top. It's kind of a step-up transformer, a little bit like a Ford buck coil, and it gives you numbers that are a good fraction of a million volts coming out of that metallic donut on the top. That in turn gives you all kinds of corona effects. The frequency is usually high enough that in some cases you can put a hand nearby, but some people don't do that. They put another metallic object that's grounded nearby and watch the arcing and sparking. So a Tesla coil used in that manner, it's not the only way you could use a Tesla coil, but a Tesla coil used in that manner to transmit on any frequency that you would want to, would be essentially a spark transmitter. Spark and arc transmitters were very popular up until, I'm going to guess, 1935 or so. And then they became unpopular because they took up such extremely large chunks of frequency spectrum, so that other nearby communication services were essentially jammed by them. So the conventional use of a Tesla coil, I'm a little bit afraid, would constitute a spark coil, and it would make quite a bit of interference to other nearby electronics. There's probably other ways to use a Tesla coil, and quite possibly Wesley's going to give us some more information on that. Let me drop for another second. I had heard about 500 kilohertz and 190 kilohertz. It's a brand new one on me that you're also allowed to transmit below 9 kilohertz. Antennas down at that lower frequency are a bit of a challenge. You no longer make the antenna, unless you've got a lot of resources and a lot of property, you're not going to be making the antenna a resonant length. Although the word resonance, in order to radiate a signal, your radiating structure must have, to efficiently radiate, electronic resonance. It doesn't have to be mechanical resonance. By that I mean a conventional dipole, you make it mechanically very close to a half wavelength long. At a frequency like 100 kilohertz, let's see, 100 kilohertz would be 3,000 meters, roughly 10,000 feet is a wavelength. Very few of us are going to put up a dipole for that kind of length. However, there are various ways you can make loops and coils and whatever that have capacitive loading devices, even just a loop with multiple turns to it, and the right kind of a capacitor across it to resonate it will begin the process. The majority of what's required for efficient transmission is a resonating structure that you call the radiating structure, and lots of current flowing through it, and hopefully you've built it out of very low loss materials so that the resonant energy has the ability to create a very strong local magnetic field. And from one point of view, that is the first step of radiation. If you can create a very strong local magnetic field at your carrier frequency, that's all that's really required to get the process rolling. After that, Mother Nature will take over. And by the time that signal gets far enough out into space, she straightens it all out. That changing, that rapidly changing magnetic field, by the Maxwell's equations, among other ways, lenses.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel. W2VL. Repeater.
And there's, once again, what you're not supposed to do. I got to start watching my watch. But Mother Nature will straighten it all out, and it eventually becomes a transverse electromagnetic wave. You only have to radiate a strong, local, changing magnetic field at the carrier rate, and you've begun the radiation process. So you'd be amazed how many people have done very efficient reception of very low-frequency signals, like the one from Scandinavia on that Alexandrusen, I think it is, Fessenden. That's a mechanical alternating device that runs at in the tens of kilohertz. I keep forgetting the frequency of the darn thing, with a huge antenna. But you can receive that signal with literally a coil of wire that you resonate, and it doesn't require a great big antenna to do it anymore, and a sensitive receiver connected to it. I'm getting the impression that part of your motivation, Wesley, is probably to really understand the nature of radio and radiated signals. But maybe you have other reasons for doing this. And the device you called a receiver selective level meter, which I guess is a kind of a field strength meter, or I'm dropping.
Frequency selective level meter. And one of them is Cushman C24 or Raycon 64.
grid dip meter I'm thinking. The so-called grid dip meter is a kind of a resonator that when it's in the oscillating mode and you put it near a resonant circuit, the resonant circuit absorbs some of the energy. The level of the oscillation decreases, the meter gives you a dip, and you know what is the resonant frequency of your external circuit. And for instance, the Heathkit and many other brands of grid dip meter also had a diode field strength meter mode where you would flip it over to this other mode and any signal that appeared across this resonant circuit would move the meter movement. And I'm guessing the Cushman has some of those properties.
It's got a speaker as well, so you can listen to it.
Very nice. So it's got a speaker, so it detects the actual level of the amplitude. Now, when it comes to building a receiver for these low and very low frequencies, should you do it as a mixer front end by way of a homemade or commercially made doubly balanced mixer, or should you use a so-called zero IF receiver? There's advantages and disadvantages of each one of those. So I am guessing that part of your motivation is to study the nature of radio by doing it at low enough frequencies where direct observation of the carrier on a conventional oscilloscope becomes possible, and I'm guessing that you're going to be researching what is the real nature of that radiated signal. I'm wondering what made you decide to favor the low frequency region as opposed to some other frequency region. Over to you, Wesley. N2XJN, wait for the beep, and watch your watch better than I did, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is N2XJN. Well, I'm trying to assemble my laboratory for actually one purpose, free energy device based on the Tesla coil, although it might sound not very professional what I'm saying, but at the same time, by trying to get all of the devices, which actually 36 pieces already either on the way, or I already have them. I sent you the email with few of them.
The time.
Okay. And I decided that I want to, since I'm dealing with a low frequency, I want to really be able to get most of whatever information I can get. That's why I've got on eBay, the guy has a pile, about 100, if I remember correctly, of this frequency selective level meter. And then, when I was searching on the internet, I've got that there is a group of ham radio operators, they are actually favoring this kind of activity, and it's being called Altair Loafer H, Altair Loafer H station, YWK. And there is another group of people, they actually build the transmitters and receivers based on Tesla coil.
Now, when you use a Tesla coil as a transmitting device, to your knowledge, Wesley, does that become, by some means, directly connected to the antenna? And even if you directly connected it to the antenna, the output of the Tesla coil, the very high voltage section, if you did it with an air gap, you'd be having a spark. If you connected it directly, you would load down the high voltage coil quite a bit. It wouldn't have anywhere near as much high voltage. But then, the method by which you excite the primary, and the method that's most popular these days, it's kind of a very healthy spark gap arrangement on the primary to do the interruption that gives you the high voltage for the Tesla. So if the primary has a spark gap or if the secondary has a spark gap, what you're going to be radiating is, yes, signals at those kind of frequencies, but it might be an extremely broadband spark-like transmission. And in the 1935 time frame and beyond, those kind of transmissions were frowned upon because they would create frequencies quite far outside of the desired transmission frequency and interfere with other pieces of equipment. So how you use a Tesla coil for transmitting is a little bit mysterious to me. Now, when it comes to the free energy devices, let me drop to MIT. Okay, Jeff recognized. We'll go over to Jeff in a second. The free energy devices, there are quite a large number of YouTube videos demonstrating people with generally rotary magnetic machinery that has very strong magnets associated with it, quite often these neodymium magnets. And some of the guys do and some of them don't, but the few that do show you instrumentation. They demonstrate by measuring voltage and current going into the machine and voltage and current coming back out, an apparent greater energy coming out than goes in, the so-called free energy phenomena. I've had a fair amount of skepticism of this. A few people have jumped to the conclusion and called it junk science, and that's a bit severe. It's a little bit, what's the word for it, prejudicial. All science is science. All science is science. To call any of it junk science is not fair. They're just the process of investigating whether or not an error is taking place when these free energy devices are being demonstrated. That in itself is some darn good science to find out what's going on. So maybe with reference to Tesla coil, Jeff has got some further information on that. So go right ahead, Jeff. K2MIT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I studied the dismal science of economics. I don't know why it was called the dismal science. It took John Forbes Nash to win a PhD to change that. But I wanted to give you an update on my PW1. I took it to Hal. It had two busted PA modules, but the thing that killed it was the power supply. Power supply was gone. Unfortunately, the amp is not built easily to change the power supply. You literally have to rip it all apart. And the part's $1,000, and probably $800 in repair bills. Let me drop it for a moment. So you're talking about $1,200, $1,400 to fix something that was worth $1,800. I agree with him, it wasn't economical. So I'm trying to figure out what to do, but I think 200 watts with my directional antenna should be fine for now. I just wanted to give you that update to the TechNet, because you asked Dick at the end of the last time. Bye-bye.
Yeah, Jeff, as you know, had the condition with his PW1 amplifier where he was putting in 100 watts and getting out close to 100 watts as opposed to the 1.5 kilowatts that he wanted it to do. It's a solid-state, very nicely built amplifier. And I did tell him at that time, please come back and let us know what you found out. When you signed in just now, Jeff, I thought you were going to be giving us information on the subject that's on the table right now, which is Wesley's laboratory that he's assembling. Wesley, if you get an email from him, he can show you some beautiful pictures of quite a few pieces of test equipment he's assembling for his laboratory. And I'm still a little bit curious about how you can use a Tesla coil as a transmitter. I don't think very many people have done that without it being considered a spark gap transmitter. So give me some information about how do you believe people have used a Tesla coil as a transmitter, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RAW in the TechNet.
2MIT, clear.
Okay, see you later, Jeff.
Okay, well, actually, the individual experimenter does not need to have a large, higher power Tesla coil transmitter. Just to learn a lot about the wireless transmission of electrical energy and produce good results. Anyone with a small state Tesla coil, I believe, can do it. Actually, smaller the better, because it is allowed to close in near field demonstration to be performed inside of the Faraday cage. What I could suggest is for the transmitter you can use 7-to-1 or 9-to-1 aspect ratio coil. And they would be winding with 1100 to 1800 turns of wire. Then position the transmitter about 25 feet or more from the ground connection, and then connect two pieces of insulated, or the best would be 12 gauge wire, lying on the ground. Then use wall filter DC power supply or battery bank. Let me drop. Okay. In conjunction with the high precision poles generator to drive a unidirectional switching circuit. And I suggest to not use the four device bridge It's a bridging circuit with like a vest on the end of my tongue. Then connect the pulse generator to the STC driver circuit with about 25 feet of RG58 coaxial cable. Then, of course, you might use a different connection. You can use a fiber optic if you want to. You start out with a pulse on duty cycle set to about 50% of duty cycle, then this is being used to control the transmitter power output. Let's move up. Okay, then what you got to do is elevate the tripod, top load, to about 1.5 times to the bottom of the secondary height above the secondary top turn. For the higher power oscillators, increase the size of the top load so the streamers do not escape from it when the transmitter is operating at maximum power. You got to be extra careful about it. Then you tune the oscillator to the first resonance frequency, the fundamental resonance frequency, by observing the reaction on the oscilloscope, an analog voltmeter, on the lowest scale you can. And then, one is connected to the ground, the other one should be connected to a nearby elevated terminal, and grounded for a grounded, what is it, the new lamp, just a moment, supported in air, 2 feet away from the transmitter is good for course adjustment. A frequency counter can also help. That's what I can say about it. What else, if your solid Tesla coefficient of coupling is tight, you're going to be losing it. Back to you, Dick, and so it's there.
The time is 8:30 p.m. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
When it comes to a transmission at 160 to 190 kilohertz, which I'm not sure is yet a ham band officially, if a person wanted to do some experiments on that frequency range, does it require a special temporary authority? In other words, must you make a separate application to the FCC in order to do that? Over to you for that question, Wesley, K2LIW in the TechNet.
1750 meters, which is 160 and 190 kilohertz, may become a ham band. You can operate this traditional band under the FCC port 15. You can. Now, everything below 9 kilohertz is beyond the jurisdiction of the FCC, is an untimed word, no laws but the laws of physics. I'm reading that. Back to you.
Okay, that's very nice that below 9 kilohertz is a license-free band. And if you're a young enough person, you'll be able to hear the output of that transmitter as an acoustic wave, even though it's electronic, because many people have good hearing up to 9 kilohertz. In my youth, I used to be able to hear the 15 kilohertz, 15750 kilohertz oscillator out of television sets, and I'd walk into a house and I could tell you exactly how many sets were on and which rooms they were in by just standing in the living room and turning my head around, if you know what I mean. Well, them days are gone forever. My hearing doesn't go that high anymore. Is there a power limitation when I'm on 160 to 190 kilohertz? In the old days, they ran a good fraction of a million watts, but I am guessing that ham radio operators must have some particular power limitation when they're on the 160 to 190 kilohertz band. Is that true, Wesley? Go ahead.
It is not true. One of the experimenters used 12 kilowatts of power. Back to you.
Wow. 12 kilowatts. Impressive.
No, it's not impressive. Not impressive because you gotta understand the voltage is high, the current is very small. Very, very small. Now, if you calculate power times voltage, power equals voltage times current, at that time, you're getting to a very high power with actually very low thickness of the wire. Back to you.
Which is a little bit similar to the technique that's used for power distribution, power transmission in the United States. Things like 13 kilovolts and 138 kilovolts and 380 kilovolt lines. When you make the voltage high enough, the current becomes low, and the impedance becomes high, and the resistance of the wiring becomes secondary. You end up with a much lower loss system. That's the good news. The bad news is that you got to use some very high towers, great big insulators, and so on to tolerate those kind of voltages, and worry about whether or not salt spray deposits on those insulators and it's making local noise and things like that.
Okay. Two words about the antenna.
Frank, go ahead. Tell me about the antenna.
So the receiving antennas, they are loop antennas. Long wires do not work. They have to be very, very long. And the ultra-loop antenna, mostly actually made from the ferrite. So you have an ultra-loop full of ferrite. And you have a wire on it. And the ultra-loop is in all access to to the ambient noise as deeply as possible. Back to you.
Which again is a beautiful example of what I think is the best way of looking at an antenna and how does it radiate. Every reasonable antenna that any of us amateur operators are going to use, you will resonate it first, then it will radiate. When I say resonate it, it means the radiating structure. The thing you call antenna, plus its transmission line, antenna tuner, tank of the amplifier, the final stage, and so on. That whole system you will resonate first. And you got to be a little bit careful about the word radiation here. If I was an electromagnetic compatibility engineer, the word radiation there would be all signals are 60, 80, or 100 dB down as far as the shielding is concerned. We amateurs, when we say radiate, we want to, let me pick a number, 50% or more of the power we've generated to go out into space. So we've got a slightly different definition of radiation, but within our definition of radiation, you will resonate first. So with ferrite and wire loop wrapped around that ferrite, you can get some beautiful antennas that are extremely small to the size. Our best example is the ferrite loop stick antenna that's in your transistorized handheld AM radio. Beautiful antenna, very tiny, and you'd be amazed how many people, let me drop, you'd be amazed how many people who wonder why isn't there a whip antenna for the AM broadcast band, for one megacycle reception, so to speak, and because that would be a very inefficient antenna. It would be much too small in wavelength to force it into resonance. It would be very difficult. In the early days of automobile AM radios, there really was a expandable whip coming out of the sheet metal of the car, and if you ever, in those days, remember using one of those radios, all you have to do is walk over to it and touch any portion of the antenna with your finger, and the reception of the AM signal essentially would disappear, or it would go down by a large number of decibels. They were, with a very elaborate circuit, forcing that thing into resonance with a great big loading coil inside somewhere, and so a finger on it would decouple it or detune it very, very rapidly. Nowadays, much more efficient antennas are being used. Sounds like you into quite a project there. So, is it a one last question I got for you, Wesley. Is this an experiment on transmitting techniques, or is it an experiment on free energy hardware, or a combination of the two? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is N2XJN. Well, actually, from all of the major techniques to achieve the free energy, HHO, using your magnet motors, and the one is Tesla. Actually, I get that the last one. So, by you actually saying that the signal has changed, and you think that you've got the over unity, but actually the the signal loop is different. That's why the voltmeter shows more, and this is not true. Well, what you're gonna say if one connects the power supply to such device, light up the bulb of 150 watts, and then disconnect completely the power. At that point, there would be no question. Of course, I'm making a joke out of myself, but let's see. It's a good experiment, and it's also a fun. Now, as far as the practice of receiving the non-directional beacons, some of these beacons are the beacons used by the military, and one of them was FSN5H25, and this one actually works in 265 to 535 kilohertz, and was able to tune in the steps of 1 kilohertz, which is actually beautiful, and it was 10 watts power. And these navigation beacons, you could actually hear from many places. They are still in operation, or ham radio amateurs from Atlanta, actually, in cooperation with ham radio amateurs from Bahamas, Canada, and Central America, are actually able to communicate using the Tesla coil right now, and they are able to communicate with using the frequency selective level meters, which actually you can buy 2-for-1 for $99 right now on the eBay. That's because the guy has so many of them and nobody wants to buy them. Back to you, Dick and Roger.
All right. Fascinating. Wesley, when you send me your next email, I would like to know one of the URLs, Universal Research Locators, in other words, one of the websites I can go to that will show radio amateurs communicating, transmitting signals with a Tesla coil. I'd like to see one of those articles. So if you make
sure. I've got one already. Check your email.
Okay. I've got to look at what email I've already gotten. And I've already gotten your email with those beautiful pictures of the test equipment for your laboratory that you've already bought. And I can tell more is on the way. Sounds to me like you're just getting rolling. Okay, I'm going to go over to the next person now, Paul, WS2N, who said he's got a question.
A comment.
Somebody's got a comment. Who was that? Start off with your call letters and your name first, sir. K2LIW.
K2CJE. I have a person that Wesley may want to contact. He's built low-frequency receiving equipment.
Okay, yeah. Give us your name and tell us the call letters of that person, Mr. GJE. Go ahead.
This is Ed, K2GJE. He may want to contact Dr. Ronald Young, WB2JJX. Over.
Okay, Dr. Ronald Young, Whiskey Bravo 2, Juliet X-ray. Has already been doing some of that. Sounds good, Ed, and I thank you for the information. Let me go over to Paul now, WS2N, who said he had a real question. All these questions are real. Go right ahead, Paul, K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, this question has to do with a Hewlett Packard HD TV. I never took one of these HD TVs apart before, but I gave it a shot. The reason being, power went out one day, and I was at from a relative's my relative's TV. They're getting kind of inexpensive. They're already found another one, but I think I'll give it a try. Try to put this thing together. What it has is a fuse that blows, a 3-amp fuse. The power supply board, you've got this fuse, you've got your plug that comes in, right near it you've got this small glass fuse, and by the way, that thing was a bad thing we were trying to repair. They had it soldered to the board. It wasn't in the connector, so I had to physically tear that thing apart, and I went to Radio Shack and bought a inline fuse holder and put my own 3-amp fuse in there, 250-volt 3-amp inch and a quarter fuse. The one that they have is a little shorter than that. But what a nightmare to try to solder that thing in there. But that was done. Let me drop it. What I'm trying to identify, because you know the fuse so blows, I'm trying to identify is a component that's right next to this fuse area, and it's about 3/4 inch in diameter. It's dark, dull green. Got some letters and numbers on them. I'll read them to you later. I cannot find any of this that data in the on the internet. The symbol, it's a nice PC board. You know, every component you look at, if it's a relay, it has K next to it. A resistor, it's got an R and a number next to it. You know, R90 for the 90th resistor or something. Capacitors, you can see the drawing of a little tiny capacitor there. So it's laid out pretty good. You're looking at the top of this PC board, and you can see all these little drawings for each component. The component I'm interested in is that's near this fuse, this 3/4 inch diameter, dull looking green round capacitor type of thing, two wires coming out of it. They have a drawing on there as well. I checked all my ARRL books, handbooks, the 2000 handbook, and other electronic books. You check the internet. I cannot find this drawing. I'll describe what it looks like. Let me drop it. The drawing that they use, it's right where the leads go in. You can see it's clearly, it looks like a resistor. Goes up and down three or four times. But surrounding this, what you would normally draw as a resistor, is this rectangular shape, not squared off, but rounded off on the corners. And that's what it looks like. I'm hoping it's a metal oxide varista. That's my guess. Because I know that they're problematic, and from what I read about them, when they short out, they might reach a high voltage, maybe 1,000 times, but sooner or later they're going to quit and short out. According to the ARRL handbook, they have something similar to it in their descriptions of varistas, metal oxide varistas. And they say there's a fuse in there. The reason the fuse is in the circuits is because if these things short out, literally short out, when they fail, they could explode or create a fire. So what they have is they run it in series with a fuse to protect that from happening. So if the current goes too high, this little 3-amp fuse blows. That's my guess of this type of circuit. I don't know that. But first of all, I have to identify this drawing, Dick, so I'll turn it back to you. WS2N.
That's a nice mystery you've got there, Paul. I was not aware that Hewlett-Packard made a high-definition television. But you said it's an HP brand name, high-definition television with that 3-ampere fuse. I'm going to make some guesses here, and hopefully people within the sound of my voice will correct me where I'm wrong. In order to make an inexpensive power supply these days, quite often the line voltage coming in, whether it be stepped down by way of a wall wart or just directly using the 115-volt line, many electronic circuits these days directly rectify the input 120 volts. 120 volts of sine wave because it is the RMS value, 120 volts. But it actually has a peak value of 167, 120 or 115, whichever is the line voltage of your neighborhood, multiplied by the square root of 2. The square root of 2 is 1.414. Multiply that out,
and you end up with something like 167 volts peak. So quite a few pieces of electronics we use these days, some computers and other things, will rectify the 110 volt, 115 volt line directly. There's 167 volts on the capacitor if there was no voltage drop in the rectifying diode, and then the circuit uses that DC voltage on that capacitor that gets rectified. The problem is that, if you happen to turn on the on-off switch at the instant that the Long Island Lighting Company, or LIPR as it's now called, is going through the peak of their applied voltage, 167 volts, and you have to recognize the fact that there's a universal rule of electronics. You cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. So if the capacitor is uncharged because you haven't been running the thing for a while, you turn the on-off switch, and at the instant that switch gets closed, that rectifying diode is trying to instantaneously put 167 volts onto that capacitor. It can't do it. The peak current at that instant of time would be infinity if the wiring had no resistance, if the diode was perfect, and the capacitor had no equivalent series resistance. So you have to have some kind of a soft start device. This green thing that you're describing sounds to me like it could be a soft start device. In other words, in the natural state, it has a significant resistance, and once it heats up, that resistance goes down to a lower number. And in the old days, that was called a bolo resistor, when television sets used to have a series wiring of all the filament wiring of all of their tubes in order to give a soft start to that particular television set. There was a resistor that would get hot, and its resistance would go down. There was a resistor with a strong negative temperature coefficient. Hotter resistor, less resistance. And of course, they would eventually wear out and break and break down and have to be replaced. I got a suggestion for you. Let me drop. First of all, I'm assuming your television set probably doesn't draw anything more than 100 watts or so. The 3-ampere fuse is there with a safety factor. Your television set probably draws a hell of a lot less than 3 amps. You could make yourself a test circuit. We start off with something like a 100-watt light bulb. I chose 100 watts because when it's running on a 115-volt line, it draws very close to 1 ampere. If you wired a 100-watt light bulb, you make yourself a little box with a 100-watt light bulb in it, and you wire it so that the 100-watt light bulb is in series with the plug going to your television set. Now, under normal conditions, no more than approximately 1 ampere will flow. I know there's a startup characteristic of the light bulb. We've got to worry about that a little bit. But if your television set was a dead short circuit, the light bulb would simply light up full brilliance. The light bulb's only drawing 1 ampere. It's not going to blow your 3-amp fuse. So the light bulb is another soft start device that even before you replace that green thing, you find out if the rest of the circuit is working. By that test and by tests with an ohmmeter, you'll find out if the diode rectifier, it's probably a bridge rectifier network, is it in good shape? If the bridge rectifier shorted out, even if this green thing was doing its job, it would still eventually blow the fuse if you happen to have a bad rectifier network. By way of your ohmmeter in the diode mode, you'd be able to check it. So step by step, you've got to confirm that you've got an operational power supply for that television set. So light bulb limiting, diode testing by way of a digital multimeter. Step by step, you will eventually figure out what's going on. Let me throw this over to the net, because I'll bet you some of these guys out there have seen similar circuits. They might have some suggestions. If you do, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, we're listening. Anybody got any suggestions? Give me your call letters right now.
K-E-Y. Hurt.
Bell recognized. Anyone else?
Yeah, Dick, let me tell you what was written on that green thing first, WS1.
Okay, first tell us what was on that green thing and wait for a beep.
Okay, the letters S-C-K, Sierra, Charlie, Kilo. And then below that was the numbers 200-200, R is in Romeo, 7. So that's it. I ran some initial tests, too. I put an ohmmeter across this thing, and it's, literally 1 ohm. So if it's a metal oxide varistor, I think it's supposed to be like an open circuit. Meanwhile, I'm showing one ohm. So that's the reason I'm thinking if it is that thing, it's failed. So I've got some other measurements too, but back to you, Nick.
And before I go over the mail, describe to me how the television set worked, how it worked the very last time you used it. Was it operating completely normally? You turned it off one day, and the very next day you turned it on, it blew the fuse. That's a guess on my part. Is that approximately the scenario you ran into, Paul? Go ahead.
Okay, I heard the tone. Yeah, my son-in-law was watching it, and it quit. It just, you know, it was on, and then it just, apparently, you know, whatever went wrong, kicked out that fuse. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so it wasn't the inrush current of turning it on the next day that did it. He was using the set at the time, and assuming there wasn't a interruption of the LIPA power going to that set, if everything was continuous and it suddenly stopped working, all of a sudden I'm becoming suspicious about that is an aggravating factor, this SCK-200R7, but it might not be the cause. It might be the bridge rectifier network that charges that capacitor. See what Mel's got to say on this one. I wonder if you run into anything similar to this one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Okay, now, so first of all, you can substitute the bulb, as Dick said, for the fuse. Instead of putting a fuse in, you can use the bulb. If the bulb lights to full brightness, you know, you got a definite dead short. Now, this device that you just mentioned, Paul, is it across the line? In other words, if you trace the line in, does this device go directly across the line? And if it is, 1 ohm surely is going to be a dead short. Is that the way it's wired, Paul, over?
Or is it wired in series? So when you look at your 110-volt line coming into this television set, Paul, and you look at this green object, is it in series with one of the wires of the 110-volt line, or is it directly across the line like some kind of a bypass capacitor? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I really don't know. Without pulling the board out, the switching power supply out, it looks like a bit of a bear to do that. I'm trying to do that without doing it. I can't tell. I'm looking at the top of the board, and unfortunately, I really don't know. I'm trying to avoid that. You know, there's all kinds of plugs and everything. My guess, I'll probably do more damage tearing the thing apart. These little Molinar plugs, and if I start pulling this thing apart, I think I could probably do more damage than I start with. By the way, I hooked up an amp. I bought an amp not too long ago. I think I remember telling you that I was going to do that. When you click around a wire, I plugged made up my own plug, a male female plug, with three separate wires where I could clip this thing around. That it's the type of amp where you have to put it around one wire, and to get a reading. So before I even plug this TV in, I made sure that this little jumper setup was in there, and I had my amp attached to it, and I could see the reading going out the way for about 4 seconds. And then the fuse quit. So that's another piece of information. I also took an ohm reading with a good fuse in there on a hot neutral, and I wind up with what I write down here, 1.9 meg, roughly 2 meg, looking at the neutral and hot. The way it is, of course, if the fuse is gone, then it's an open line. Back to you, Dick.
AC2OJO with the comment.
Okay, KC2OJO. By the way, I just Googled the word SCK-200R7, and the first thing that came up was the thermistor series, SCK series of thermistors. So far, that's beginning to look like a good guess. KC2, Oboe, Juliet, Oboe. Please start up with your name, and then tell us your comments, sir. K2LAW, my name is Dick.
Okay, the name is Howard, KC2OJL, and basically I was responding because I had just Googled the same part and found that it's a negative temperature resistance power thermistor. That would make a lot of sense if it's in series with the capacitor, because what happens when the thermistor is set on, the capacitor is initially uncharged, and then it's opposite the bridge rectifier. So at that point, you can put an enormous amount of current into that capacitor and blow the fuse. If the panel negative temperature resistance thermistor is operating properly, it's going to start out in a higher resistance, and so it will limit the original surge of current, and then possibly as it warms up from operation, it will allow the power supply to operate normally as its resistance goes down, pretty much close to zero as the temperature goes up. So as a guess, having done the same thing you just commented on, Dick, of Googling the SCK200R7, it sounds like it should be in series and that it's trying to protect the surge on turn-on, and maybe that's the component that fails, so intermittently, when you turn it on, the capacitor across the bridge rectifier sees too much of a surge and that blows the fuse. Back to you, Dick.
EY with a comment.
Well recognized. And Howard, I think you're right on. We're all slowly concluding that that green object is most likely a soft start component, negative temperature coefficient resistor-like device. The fact that he's now measuring 1 ohm when it's cold suggests that it has failed. However, its failure may be a cascading of other events. In other words, the possibility exists that the bridge rectifier slowly went into a failure mode, and or the capacitor that's beyond the bridge rectifier, which is the beginning of this switching power supply, that it developed high leakage or a short within it, and therefore, until the fuse blew, the thermistor was being overstressed. That's a possible scenario here. So even though he's replaced the fuse and just another one there will simply blow again, and he didn't do it with a 100-watt light bulb in series, which he's going to be doing later on, and even if he could replace this thermistor-like device, if that's what it is, he still may have another kind of a failure to iron out. So we're slowly concluding it's a soft start device, and even if it's in the failure mode, if the rest of the circuit is working correctly, Paul, if your bridge rectifier, your capacitor, and the rest of the power supply is working correctly, you can force your own soft start, and you've got a couple of different ways you can do it. One, you can use a variac and slowly turn up the 110 volts from zero up to 115, so to speak, and watch the current as you do it with your clamp-on ammeter, and make sure you don't exceed, let me pick a number, 2 amperes, because, you know, as you approach 3 amperes, you just simply blow the fuse again, or the 100-watt light bulb circuit. There's various ways you can step-by-step do your own soft start. Variac or light bulb is the one that I would prefer. I bet you Mel's got another suggestion for you. K2KEY, K2LIW.
And this is K2KEY. Well, you more or less said the right thing, Dick. First of all, you can substitute for the fuse, put the light bulb in place of the fuse. Number two, Paul, you're going to have to get to the board, and I would disconnect this little device. Take it off and see what happens. If the light bulb continues to light bright, then you can say, yes, this may have failed, but something else has failed. In other words, you're going to have to go further. But if this is a soft start device, and you disconnect it and you see the light bulb dim down, you may find that all is wrong. But this way you'll know. The light bulb continues to light bright in place of the fuse light bulb. You'll know for sure that there's a lot more wrong than this device. You see if it'll work without. In other words, you're going to have to get to the bottom of the board to unsolder this one, pull one pin of this device off the board, Paul, over.
The time is 9:00.